I'm Josh Hamilton.
And I'm Joe Skinner.
And this is the American Masters podcast, where we have conversations with the people who change us. Today, we talk to comedian Chris Gethard.
All I've ever done is worked hard and tried to be honest and tried to connect with an audience who's looking for the type of values I bring to my work. And I don't ever want to apologize for that. I'd rather connect with 200 people who identify with the idea of being earnest or vulnerable or sad at times than a football stadium full of people who don't.
Chris Gethard grew up in West Orange, New Jersey, and is a proud Jersey guy. Known for a confessional style of comedy, he's never one to shy away from inserting very personal stories into his work.
Yeah, he's a real salt-of-the-earth guy, too. He definitely has a Bruce energy.
He mines this personal history in Jersey in his book, Lose Well, where he emphasizes the importance of failing and uses some hilarious and dark episodes from his own life to illustrate the point.
This is kind of a defining quality in his work. In his HBO special, Career Suicide, Chris details his own struggles growing up with mental health issues, and it's pretty groundbreaking in the way that it destigmatizes medication. It's alarmingly honest, and it's really more of a one-man show in the vein of Spalding Gray than a comedy special. The foundation of it all is personal biography.
He strikes me as an artist who's really actively practicing empathy, which is not necessarily something that comedy usually brings out in people. There's kind of always been a dividing line in comedy, and it feels especially present right now, between sincerity and irony, and Gethard may be the spokesman of sincerity. His podcast, Beautiful Anonymous, further blurs the line between comedy and drama.
Yeah, he tweets out a phone number, a stranger calls it, and he has to talk to them for an hour straight. Since he has a background in improv at the Upright Citizens Brigade, Chris is able to navigate these calls into some pretty intense territory.
Gethard's career is hard to define. You might know him as an actor on The Office, Broad City, or in the film Don't Think Twice. And we'd be remiss not to mention maybe his most legendarily hard-to-define work, the public access project The Chris Gethard Show, which ran just shy of 10 years across multiple platforms. And he's constantly touring and performing stand-up around the country. He's a very busy guy. But he took some time to sit down with Joe recently here in the studio.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I was just reading your book, Lose Well, and something that I found really universal about it is just that middle school really sucks.
Yeah. Junior high school was probably the worst stretch of my life, yeah.
What about this time period really helped set you on a path towards a life in performance and comedy, do you think?
Well, you know, the surface level answer is that I look like I do and my last name spells out the words get hard. So as far as feeling like a little bit of an outsider looking in, I think the bar was set pretty high around that age. And I think a lot of comedians and a lot of performers are people who maybe feel that way a little bit, like they're on the outside looking in. And I kind of have this theory that maybe when you feel that way, you spend a lot of time analyzing the world in front of you and trying to figure out what it is that's not clicking, and therefore you can comment on it from the perspective of a comedian and say, yeah, it was rough. It was a rough time. That stretch of my life was, I went to a school that was pretty poorly run looking back on it. The kids were kind of on their own, and I walked out of it with a chip on my shoulder for sure.
And was there a specific moment from this time period where you kind of were able to dive into performance?
Oh, of course. Yeah, you're leading me towards that particular story. I thought we were talking about the more broad sociological aspects. Yeah, so when I was in eighth grade, a couple friends of mine convinced me to try out for the school musical because they lived on the other side of town. And, you know, when you're spread out like that, you don't really get to hang out that often. So they were like, yeah, just do this. We'll get to hang out all the time. And I joined up and inexplicably got like a non-chorus part. I thought I was just going to be in the chorus. But I got cast as the part of Randolph in Bye Bye Birdie, which is the little brother in the main family. And if you know the show Bye Bye Birdie, it's about this Elvis-like guy coming to a small suburban town and everybody's flipping out. And the kid who played Conrad Birdie, like the kid who played Elvis, he's just Elvis, right? Like they just couldn't get the rights to the name. The kid who played Elvis was my friend Danny Tobia, and he was the coolest kid. And he got in a fight with the director and left. And I had the whole show memorized because I was a nerd. And last minute, they switched, and I became Conrad Birdie. And I just rewatched the video of it recently because I was working on the book and telling that story, and it's really cringy. I was a solid foot shorter than most of the girls who were flipping out about me, and I had a very, very regrettable bowl haircut and very weird outfits, and the stage moms who did makeup just kind of like threw a bunch of mascara and rouge on my prepubescent head and marched me out there. And I got big laughs, though. I remember getting big laughs, and that I'll never, ever forget the first night that I went on stage and did that, because I remember so well that I remember being aware, oh, they're laughing at me. Like, a kid who looks like I did, like, people shouldn't be fainting with, you know, sexual, overwhelming want. No one should be doing that to me, a doughy-faced little boy who looks like I'm 8 years old. So I understood I was being laughed at, but I loved it. And when the curtains closed, I remember just standing on the stage, just kind of like jumping up and down and spinning in a circle with all this energy. And that was really out of character for me at that age to show that much sort of just energy and enthusiasm. So definitely sort of got thrown into the shark pit as far as being a public performer with this situation that was very sort of weird and in a way almost sort of like a performance art take on this popular musical. And I think you can look at a lot of the stuff I've been interested in since, and it's probably trying to recapture that feeling of making an audience just go, what are we looking at right now? Why is this funny to us? This feels like it's not reality as we know it.
And I know you talk really openly about dealing with anxiety in your performance. As a kid, you know, dealing with anxiety, it feels sort of counterintuitive to connect so much with such a public act.
Yeah. It's something I've thought about a lot. And the best I can say is that it never felt confusing to me, even though it's been consistently people have said, like, oh, for someone who is so often scared to have a conversation or so often apologizing to everyone for everything, it's kind of an odd choice to get on stage. But the best I can say is that when I am on a stage, that's when I actually feel the most comfortable. And I might actually say the most powerful. Like, when I have a mic in my hand and everybody therefore is honor bound to listen and I can get a room full of people laughing, I always feel like on some level those people are, their laughter is saying to me, oh, we get it. We understand. We feel that way too. And I hope that gives the audience a lot, and I know it gives me a lot. So yeah, it's funny. Last night I did one stand-up set, so it was 15 to 20 minutes, and those were definitely the 15 to 20 minutes where I felt most confident, comfortable, like myself, in my own skin. Yesterday was a really hard day for me, actually, filled with a lot of bad feelings and self-doubt, which I still suffer from all the time. And that 15 minutes on stage, which for most people would be the most terrifying 15 minutes they could imagine, is for me the only 15 minutes where I feel sane.
Yeah, you write about it in the book too. There's this part where you say that, you know, something about you use performance as an opportunity to kind of take control of certain things and take control of situations where otherwise you may not have had that kind of power, and it gives you and affords you that kind of power.
Yeah, I mean, I'm someone who legitimately gets interrupted all the time, ignored all the time, just like very, I know what cloth I'm cut from. Like, you see me in a line at a bodega and like people liberally feel okay about just cutting me in line. And I say that just to be like, I have always lived this sort of Charlie Brown life. Like, even the other day I did a show in London and I flew back and my seat was directly next to the toilet. It's a 7.5 hour flight. And like, friends of mine tell me, they'll be like, oh, why are you still so like nervous about your career? You've like, you're over the hump and you're a little bit famous now. And I'm like, if that is true, it doesn't change the fact that I get just like jammed in next to the toilet and big timed by everybody all the time. So performing is certainly a way for me to grab onto some sense of agency and sort of have a little bit of a voice once or twice a day. Sorry, I feel like this is becoming a bummer. That's on brand for me. So, yeah.
Was there a moment when you realized that, you know, looking back and mining some of these stories from your youth or from any part of your life, really doing kind of an autobiographical approach to comedy, was there a moment when you realized that this was going to be kind of the next step in your career?
There's a few that stand out. One that I think about a lot is that I came up as an improviser and came up at the Upright Citizens Brigade during an era when it was just kind of like a success factory. Like, you'd see people getting on sitcoms all the time, students of mine who I taught in improv classes, you know, the two guys who I felt closest to coming up, one of them wound up on The Office, one of them wound up on SNL, and it just wasn't happening for me. And I realized that I'm not strong at characters, and I'm not strong at voices and these things that these actors do, but what I am good at is being myself and letting people see how I feel on stage. And there's a show called ASCAT at UCB that's been running on Sunday nights for decades now, and they started having me go up and do the storytelling part instead of the improvising part. And that really was a thing that made me realize, oh, I'm good at being myself. Mike Birbiglia told me recently, he's been a mentor to me over the years, and he told me recently, he's like, you know, you're the only person to come out of UCB who's known for being yourself. Everyone else is known for playing actors. So I think sort of as I maybe fell out of love with improv was when I started connecting to this idea of maybe I can just be me. Maybe that's the most interesting thing I have to offer. I'm never going to be as funny as my pal Bobby Moynihan, but I can be more honest than anyone else I know. I'm comfortable just sort of eating it in public and letting people see the rough edges and the dark sides. And I think if I'm good at anything, it's sort of taking it on the chin publicly and letting everybody experience that with me and seeing what happens on the other side of it.
When you were at UCB, you had something called the Magic Bus of Stories.
Yes. That kind of built out of the ASCAT experience that I said. So I started telling these stories on stage, and people started flipping out. And things started happening where this group of kids at the time, they were freshmen at NYU, they all started showing up. And one day, I go into the green room, and some of the staff at the UCB is like, hey, there's all these kids out there, and they have T-shirts. They drew your face on them. They drew your name on them. And I was like, oh, what's going on? And I realized that, you know, I was up there with all these legitimate celebrities. And I mean, these shows would be Amy Poehler, Seth Meyers, Jack McBrayer, Jason Sudeikis, and Chris Gethard. And I realized I was becoming kind of like the people's champ. Like, they were rooting for me so hard as this, like, guy right on the fringe of this thing. And these kids, I thought they were messing with me. I thought it was a joke, and I thought they were making fun of me, and it actually hurt my feelings. And they said, no, we really love your stories. We want to see the places in New Jersey where they took place. So I kind of called their bluff. This was all on Facebook. And I was like, all right, yeah, let's rent a bus and go, thinking it would be the end of it. And they'd go, all right, yeah, we'll back down. But no, they called bus companies, and it sold out instantly. And I mean, like, within like 20 minutes, we'd sold out like 60 seats on a bus. So people could follow me around New Jersey, and I could be like, So this is the basement. This is the basement of my old. I lost my virginity right here on a couch. Used to be, and we're like in the basement of the house where I grew up. And the guy who owns the house now, I'll never forget, he's in the back of the room, and I tell that story, and he just goes, "Come on, man, come on, man." And like, it was this very odd day where I realized that something had broken through, and I was maybe underestimating the validity of what I had stumbled into, and a lot of these younger kids at the time were genuinely rooting me on, and it wasn't a joke, and that I had maybe fallen into some sort of performance style that was a little bit hard to define, and that was kind of on the edge of storytelling and performance art, but that nobody else was doing, and it got a bunch of press. It was the first thing I ever did that anybody kind of cared about outside of just the tiny little improv scene, and it was life-changing. It was life-changing, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those people. I keep my eye on them. One of the people who was in that early wave of my supporters actually just was cast on Saturday Night Live, which is such a fascinating thing to see, to have been around so long, where it's like, oh, one of the people who was, you know, rooting me on in 2009, 10 years later, he gets cast on Saturday Night Live. It's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful full circle thing to see.
Yeah, I feel like mentorship and this mentor-mentee approach has been pretty consistent across your career.
Yeah.
People often talk about you discovering or nurturing a lot of young talent that's gone on to great things.
I'm really proud of it. I remember what it felt like to be this guy renting a bus, feeling like, man, this is really weird. And I doubted it. I would do these performance art sort of projects that were just kind of experimental. And then I'd get embarrassed and be like, well, my friends are on The Office. I'm doing a weird show where we shoot each other with paintballs in front of a crowd. And I'd get really embarrassed. And I remember that feeling of being alone in it, feeling like no one else was doing it. So I remember a lot of the people who mentored me and how much that helped. And I have always felt honor bound when the other young bucks come along and I see some of the other people who are trying the strange stuff. I always reach out, and if there's any world in which I can lend a helping hand, I do. And you know, my TV show that kind of was born out of this whole attitude eventually went to cable, and I was able to give a lot of people their first job.
Have you intellectually thought of what you're doing as community building?
Yeah, I mean, I was aware that was a major element of it. Even if you look at when my show was on public access, which was such a game changer for me, everyone on the crew had a nickname. We all hung out. Everybody got sucked into being on camera. It's just, I hate to be depressing, but for most of my life, I've felt like someone who did not have a community. So I had to kind of go and build my own.
We should definitely talk about this foundational piece of your career, the Chris Gethard Show, and how it started. I mean,
it goes back 10 years now, which I was hoping to keep it alive for 10 years. I thought that would be a nice round number, but it's very much within the sort of story of the show and the ethos of the show to crap out at 9, to come up one short. That's kind of everything you need to know about the show, is that we were hoping to make it to 10. Nope, got canceled at 9. The show started at UCB. I had been doing a lot of the storytelling stuff and a lot of the odd stuff, and the artistic director there, I sat down with him at one point, and I give him so much credit because, you know, I said, I kind of want to do a talk show live on stage, and he was like, well, that's been done to death. Everybody's done it, but he's like, I want to give you a slot. You do a talk show that reflects the fact that you rent buses and have done all this other, like, I once had a show where comedians were boxing each other on stage, like, just stuff that was just weird, man. And he's like, just own all that stuff, and that's what you do best, and do it. And it blew up, and it's kind of, you know, I don't want to, like, buy into too much legend building or mythology building, but I can look back now that it's over and realize, like, there was just some stuff that happened that was magic. Like, very early into the run of the show, I went on Twitter, and this was in 2011, did we start it? This was around 2011. Yeah, the bus tour was 2009. And it was in Twitter's early days is the point. And people hadn't really figured it out. And I asked Diddy, Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, if he would come do my show. And inexplicably, he was like, yeah, what's your show? I'll come do it. And everybody flipped out. And I think it was written about as one of the early things where people were like, oh, Twitter's an actual tool that can connect people across boundaries. Like, I should not have access to Sean Combs in any world, especially back then, let alone now. And he just came and did it. And it became this thing where it took him 13 months to actually show up. And every month people thought he was coming so that the show would sell out. And then the stuff we were doing, the people I was showing off as this hot crowd would show up, it became this movement. And we switched over to public access TV as I thought the show was dying out. And a guy I knew from, I had taught him in an improv class. He's like, I work at the public access station. You should come do it. Your show would be great on public access. And at first I was like, oh my God, like, that's kind of cringy to be told you would be great on public access. And then once I got over the ego, I was like, man, they have a 3-camera studio. They stream it all online. You can do the show live. And it just, I would say the first 4 or 5 months on public access were really difficult, hard to push through, hard to find an audience. And then when things clicked, it just became this sort of gang of renegades beaming out comedy to the world that often didn't even work. But then we'd start getting calls. I remember we'd be getting prank calls from within Manhattan. And then all of a sudden we're getting calls from Jersey. Now we're getting calls from Connecticut. Now wait, hold. And then I remember like the first night we got a call from Canada. It was like, what? And then all of a sudden within a year or two, we're getting calls from Sweden, from Brazil. We sold a pilot of the show to Comedy Central. A guy flew from Honolulu. A girl flew from Brazil. People flying from San Francisco just to attend our pilot taping, our studio audience pilot taping. Like, I started to realize there were a lot of outcasts spread all over the world who came to view this weird little show as representing them. In the same way that I remember punk rock bands making me feel that way. I mean, we had people from all over Australia. Someone once told me they were watching the show on an iPad in the back of a convertible in Dubai. Once got an email from someone who said they had to hack a firewall in China just to watch our show. I'm like, committing crimes that the Chinese government would be mad about just so you can see a show that's literally at times like me laying on a table shirtless having a burrito built on my belly. Like, this is not, there's no world in which I would claim that this is high art, but something about the attitude behind it actually maybe did attain that status for a certain segment of the population.
And you were literally dragging the studio gear in and out of your car.
Oh, it was pathetic. It was, I had a Ford Fiesta. First, it was a Nissan Sentra. At some point, I upgraded to Ford Fiesta. But point being, tiny trunk of the car, and like any prop we had had to live in the trunk of my car. There's no storage space of public access. So I would, every Wednesday night, it almost became this weird ritual for me. It almost became this weird, and this is like the Irish Catholic in me that feels like you have to have a ritual to punish yourself in order to earn anything. There's many psychological layers, but I'd park the car on 59th Street and 11th Avenue, and, you know, the closer I could get to the studio, the better, but very often I'd be around the block, and I'd have, you know, we had a big banner made out of canvas, we had a stand for the banner, we had a big suitcase full of all sorts of wires and hard drives and stuff, and then on top of that, any props we had for the show, which with our show, it would be like, okay, now I have four Nerf guns and a bag of, you know, pardon my French, double-headed dildos, and it would be me with all this stuff balanced on my back, dragging the suitcase behind me and, like, you know, 50, 60 pounds of gear on my own back, and I'd schlep it up to the studio, and sometimes it would be funny because I'd pass kids who were, like, killing time in the neighborhood who were, like, we're coming to the show. You know, there'd be somebody who'd be like, I've been watching your show for years, and I took a bus from Michigan, and I'm like, yeah, this is me dragging all this junk up the sidewalk myself. And it felt like I'm never going to phone it in. I'm never going to ask people to put in work that I'm not willing to put in. And every week my crew will see me sort of stumble in with all this stuff on my own back as this sign that I know we're in it together. And it's not about me, and it's not about getting my name out there. It's not about my ego getting stroked. It's about us really trying to do something together that is allowed to fail and that doesn't prescribe to anything that the mainstream would push upon us, and that, in fact, sometimes often didn't make sense intentionally or failed ambitiously, almost in a way to sort of throw up a middle finger specifically to the idea of mainstream comedy. And then, of course, we eventually got picked up by cable, which was very, very nice. But we were, I look back and realize that the story of the show is the show of a public access studio. And then in very stereotypical fashion, the pressure of being on a network and their mandates did eventually, I think, squeeze a lot of the attitude out of it. And that's when I knew it was time to end it. They kind of called me up and they said, we're willing to keep going if you are majorly down to restructure things. And I said, no, we got to let it. I gotta let the legend of this thing be what it is. I'll be mad at myself forever if I totally water down what I do in the name of money. Can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a lot of going to underground shows when I was a kid, or going to see some music when I was a kid, and then eventually those venues shutting down and it being this kind of cathartic process. You said music was a big part of this for you too, growing up.
It was huge. It was huge. And I look back and realize that I owe such a debt to, you know, the independent music that I think started rolling, you know, this idea of punk rock being intentionally sort of like outsider art that lived outside the mainstream that started in the 70s, and then moving on to, you know, college rock being like a distribution system where people could find non-traditional stuff. The bands that I look back to, you know, thinking about how like Black Flag toured relentlessly, slept in church, Minor Threat, a lot of these bands that I think really built the infrastructures of being an independent artist. I feel like, I won't say I was the first by any means, but I definitely maybe took one of the biggest swings at emulating some of their attitude and some of their infrastructure. And I never forgot my first punk rock show ever. I was in eighth grade, entering, is it the summer between eighth grade and ninth grade? I'll never forget just the feeling of shock that the people on stage were only a few years older than me, and they hadn't asked anyone's permission. And it didn't necessarily sound great, but they also, they had their t-shirts and they had their records and their tapes for sale, and they just went and did it. And I just always had a little bit of anger in me and always found that to be quite inspiring. And I really thought a lot about music when I was building my show on Public Access. I thought about music a lot more than I thought about comedy, actually. And, you know, as I was feeling these stresses about friends of mine getting these mainstream gigs and me just whiffing on that hard, had to really reconcile and say, it's so arrogant to be mad about that because my friends are getting sitcom jobs and I don't watch sitcoms. And that's not a judgment. I'm not rolling my eyes. Millions and millions of Americans love them, and that's beautiful. I don't watch them. So what am I exactly searching for to want to be on one, to be on a type of entertainment I roll my eyes at? Friend of mine, you know, getting on SNL. I almost got a writing job at SNL at one point. It devastated me. I didn't get it. But again, no offense. I have friends who work there. You know, I've seen brilliant stuff come out of the show. I don't watch it. I don't watch it. It's not for me. So I'd sit there and really realize I'm probably betraying my own values or my own ethics, chasing these traditional versions of success. I never once locked in with a band who played stadiums. I wanted to be in a VFW hall or a church basement. I wanted to look them in the eye. I wanted to be there with 30 other people feeling like I was getting something personal. So I had to kind of pump the brakes on my own ego and start building entertainment that felt like that.
A lot of your work is refusing to just stick to one genre of just capital C comedy. It feels like you're really trying to pull together all these different places.
For better or for worse. For better or for worse, because it makes it very, very hard to define. You know, it's kind of hard to get momentum going when no one can quite explain to their friends what you like. Oh, you got to check out this show where they, you know, the most famous episode we ever did, we wound up putting, the whole premise was we put a human being in a dumpster and people had to call up and guess who was in the dumpster. And that doesn't sound totally appealing to someone who likes How I Met Your Mother, you know? And I get it. And I get it, but it is hard to describe and hard to latch onto. But I think for a person of a certain mentality, it feels like something that maybe makes them kind of like pound their chest with a little bit of pride that there's still some strange stuff that exists.
Yeah, you mentioned the artistic director at UCB, Anthony King, and he said that you've become an adjective for weird.
There was a stretch. There was a stretch in New York where the phrase a Gethard show had gone beyond just the show I was staging, and people being like, yeah, I kind of want to do like a Gethard show thing where, and that would invariably mean like, we're going to set up four kiddie pools and fill them with pudding and the whole audience has to like dive in there looking for a key to a safe that, and it would always be some like elaborate nonsense and my name, and sometimes I'd hear that stuff and I'd be like, oh, that's awesome, and then sometimes I'd be like, oh my, that's what my name is getting attached to now, all right, decade in this business and that's what it's come to, all right.
And in mixing all these different styles and you know, I think often mixing drama with comedy or tragedy with comedy you know, eventually leads to another huge highlight in your career, Career Suicide on HBO.
Yeah, that's outside of character acting gigs, I would say that's the thing I've spearheaded that is the most likely that you have actually heard of if you're hearing this interview. It was a special on HBO where I talked pretty in depth about my mental issues and some flirtations with suicide. And yeah, that was a big one. I'll probably never do anything I'm more proud of than Career Suicide.
Did Career Suicide always have a confessional style from the earliest invocation of it?
Yeah, my stand-up in general does. When I started doing stand-up, I very much gravitated towards the storytelling style, not really setups and punchlines. And you know, thinking about storytelling style someone I linked up with was Mike Birbiglia, who I think if you follow comedy, I think he's probably one of the people who's most known for sort of fleshed out stories, narratives within his work. And I'd been doing comedy a long time, but I went to Mike. I saw him at a festival. We were doing Bonnaroo together, and he saw me perform. He said, "Dude, you're getting a lot better at stand-up." And I said, "If you need an opener, I'll do it." And I knew that I was humbling myself because I'd already been around for, you know, over a decade. But I also knew I would learn a lot, and I'm a big fan of getting out of my own way when it comes to ego. So I was doing it with Mike and telling these confessional stories on stage, you know, in my own work and then opening for him. And we had this night where we were driving through the middle of the country in between two of his shows. And he was like, you mentioned this depression stuff in your work. What's the most real it ever got? And I told him a story I had told probably less than a dozen people in my whole life, which was about a time that I was in a car wreck. And it was something that I knew was happening and allowed to happen because I thought it was a good way to, you know, to pass away intentionally without being judged. And I told him the story, and I'll never forget, we're driving through Iowa or Kansas or somewhere, and he just pauses, and he's like, "Wow, that's hilarious. You got to tell that on stage." And I was like, "That's the darkest, saddest thing I've ever been through." And he's like, if you can connect with that, it's going to be something really special. And kind of made it clear in the course of that conversation of it might be something that people connect with in a way that they're not getting elsewhere. And that, again, I always think back to when I was 13, 14 years old, and then again when I was 19, 20 years old, and I was terrified of this side of myself. I couldn't find much of anything that spoke to it. So if I can make the thing that speaks to it, and there's someone else out there who feels lonely, scared, sad all the time, lonely all the time, if I can just send something out there that lets them know, hey, there's someone else out here who understands, it would actually be very selfish not to.
And was it challenging to kind of have to relive this over and over again? Because you're performing this over and over.
Worst. It was hard. It was hard. I did it. I workshopped it for well over, I think, about a year and a half. And then I did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where you go and do it 29 nights in a row in Scotland, like a country where I know no one. And then I did it off-Broadway. And when I did it off-Broadway, I was doing it 6, 7, sometimes 8 times a week with the matinees. And there was a really sad stretch where my wife was out of town. She was working on the road in her own right. She's out of town, and I'm getting up on stage 8 times a week telling jokes about the time I tried to kill myself. It was hard. It was hard. And then I beamed it out to the world in HBO and felt immensely proud to get there, but was also quite happy to move on. And my own relationship with that piece moving forward has been very difficult because it's opened the floodgates to having to think about it all the time from my perspective and other people's perspectives. But yeah, I definitely felt like, not to be too dramatic, but I felt like I bled a little bit for the sake of the greater good, and I can't. That left some scar tissue.
Was it surprising to see the reactions to the show?
It was. It was really eye-opening. I mean, I had people coming up to me saying, "I've never told anybody I'm depressed, and that's the first I've ever heard someone talk about it where it rings true to me." And I had people telling me, "I'm going to go get help for the first time," or "I'm going to go get back on meds," which was amazing. Made me feel again like, man, I bet if I had this when I was 15, I wouldn't have suffered as much. And the ones that were more meaningful, sometimes people come up to me and go, "I've always thought my kid was just a dramatic baby about stuff." But I'm realizing, no, I have to take it seriously. You know, had someone who told me they had a kid who was only 7 or 8 years old whose doctor was trying to prescribe the meds, and they were resistant and rolling their eyes at it. And they said, "You know, I don't know if we're going to go that route, but we're going to take it more seriously." You know, had some people tell me, would say things like, "You know, my brother took his own life, and it was really hard to watch your show, but I think I maybe understand how he's feeling more than I used to." And to hear people say things like that in a positive way, made me feel good. And as you can hear from my long pause, good in a layered way that has a lot of confusion behind it. but ultimately I felt like, you know, I'm pretty content that at some point I'll be on my deathbed and I'll know that I at least tried to do my part to make the world a little bit easier for people for whom it is often hard. I'll feel good about that.
I feel like you really flew with that with Beautiful Anonymous, your podcast. You know, it's you mentioned earlier that it's so hard to describe a lot of the stuff you do. And there's this kind of amazing moment in your career where Beautiful Anonymous comes out. And it's actually kind of remarkably easy to explain what the show is.
Yeah. Finally, I did a thing that someone can explain it in two sentences and their friend will go, oh, that sounds cool. Finally, something easy. Yeah, it's a podcast where I tweet out a phone number and whoever calls, we pick one person and then I talk to them for an hour and they don't tell me their name and that way they're allowed to feel some freedom to share and I just can't hang up for an hour. And that's it. An hour-long phone call from an anonymous person talking about their life. Nice and simple and clean and easy.
I mean, this show really feels like it's a continuation of Career Suicide almost to me.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
I remember early episodes, it really felt more like kind of a straight comedy podcast. Do you even consider it a comedy podcast anymore?
No. And that took a lot. I had to reconcile that. It was featured on This American Life, and they put out an episode that I think was much more serious than funny. And that meant that all the people who found it through that show, and I'm so, so incredibly grateful that they spread word on it, but all the calls coming in were serious. But again, I had to realize it's not about me. It's my insecurity that this isn't reflecting that I'm a comedian. That I was very insecure about it, but insecurity gets you nowhere. And I had to realize it was something that meant a lot to people. And when I take a step back and look at it, you know, I look at the Gethard show, which was so weird, and Career Suicide, which I poured so much work into, and Beautiful Anonymous. And I think the thing they all have in common is that there is a real effort behind all of them to say, you are not alone out there. Like, you know, all of them have that, and they're just poured into containers of different shapes.
Was there a episode of Beautiful Anonymous that made you realize that this is the direction the show's really going in?
The first one was a guy who hated his job and was sitting in his car. I'll never forget, he was working in a place called Bank Tech, which I thought was a hilariously grim name for a job that you don't, if you don't like it. And he was talking about how he wanted to move on, but he was scared. And I convinced him to just start shouting as loud as he could to vent his rage. And I mean, so many of the calls just blew my mind, you know. One where someone told me what it was like to escape from a religious cult. One that I think has been massively impactful on me was a mother who called from the waiting room of a hospital because her daughter was awaiting results for some cancer tests. Calls where people talk about their sexuality and where I feel very proud knowing, like, my show, there's probably some people in the world who the first time they ever heard a trans person tell their own story in their own words was on my show. There's one that I think was really eye-opening where in early 2016, we had a call from a lady who was planning on voting for Trump. She was very, very enthusiastic about it and could not explain why. And this was an era where I was going, I was very respectful, but I'm like, he mocked a reporter for their disability. And she'd go, yeah, no, I can't get behind that. I'm like, yeah, but he makes immigrants feel like they're going to get killed. He's whipping them up. Yeah, no, I don't like that part. I'm like, I like that part. And I always think back to that, and I'm like, oh, I wish that some Democratic strategists had made me listen to that episode, because I think it was an early canary in the coal mine of this sort of unrelenting support for a guy who had some major flaws. I don't know. A bunch. I'm always blown away. The answer is that I never cease to be amazed by the stories I hear from regular people on Beautiful Anonymous. Never.
Your background in improv really kind of ties it all together for me. It makes it...
I think so.
Give it an extra spark, I think.
Yeah, and it's funny with Beautiful Anonymous, oftentimes the people on the phone don't realize I'm playing by the rules of improv. Like, I got to a point where I'm cocky about very few things, but I was a very good improviser and a very good improv teacher. And all those skills are still there. And as far as listening, I spent about a decade training myself to listen harder than people normally listen. And a lot of times on the show, I sort of internally giggle because I'm like, oh, I'm just the straight man in a comedic scene. But it's not a comedic scene. It's a phone call about something grim from your life. But I'm still playing by the rules of being an active listener.
Do people more often or less often know the game that's happening?
I'd like to think they don't. I'd like to think that it's a show that I think on at its best day, people would listen and go, oh, anyone could be the host of that show. But if they sat down to actually do it, they'd go, oh, this is actually a tightrope to walk. And I'd like to think that I hide that tightrope part of it as often as possible. If only because, A, I think that that's a reflection of skillful entertainment that you don't see, you know, you don't see the gears. And also I think it makes the caller on the line feel safe to know that there's somebody really locking in with them. And they don't need to see the strain of any particular training or strategy I have. They just need to feel safe in conversation with me.
We've kind of entered an era with comedy where there's become this huge backlash against political correctness in a lot of ways in the comedy world. And I see you kind of as a flag bearer for earnesty and sincerity in a lot of ways. Do you see yourself in that way?
I do. But I'd also like to think I'm not out there criticizing other people who aren't that. And I just don't understand why sometimes it's viewed as weakness to be vulnerable in your work with comedy. It's baffling to me. And I'd like to think that maybe I've helped carve out a space. And I'm certainly not the only one. There's people, you know, people I really admire. You know, some of the names that come to mind right away, Maria Bamford, Tig Notaro. People have really put some stuff out there that's personal and raw and real. Mike Birbiglia, again, I bring his name up. He's been a great influence on me. Like, a lot of people who have done it. And I'd like to think that I'm a part of that. And just the week that we're recording this, I got crushed by another comedian who called me out hard on a podcast, and it wound up, it was one of a few things he said that made some national news, and I did not appreciate being sucked into it. And all I've ever done is worked hard and tried to be honest and tried to connect with an audience who's looking for the type of values I bring to my work, and I don't ever want to apologize for that. And it maybe will make me forever live as a little bit more of a niche artist or a little bit more of an underground artist, but I'd rather connect with 200 people who identify with the idea of being earnest or vulnerable or sad at times than a football stadium full of people who don't. And God bless all the people who can sell enough tickets to sell a football stadium. It's awesome. It's amazing. It's good for all of us that there's that many options out there. But yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm an outlier for being earnest. And sometimes I feel like within the comedy scene, I get judged pretty harshly for it. But all I do is work hard, and I can't apologize for that.
Do you think comedy is reflective of society at large?
I will say that having been around the New York comedy scene for 20 years, I have found it increasingly strange that it feels like comedy has become this sort of like bellwether that's a societal predictor. If you look at the downfall of some of the, you know, some of the most popular comedians of their era, it clearly kind of were a precursor or an early part of the Me Too movement. And look at how people talk about things like race and gender, and there's so many think pieces about what comedians say and do about this stuff. And I go back and forth because on some level I find it very strange that an art form as disposable as comedy is a thing that people get so worked up and mad about. But there's also a very strange sign of the times too, where there's a lot of comedians that I think feel very genuinely committed to being woke, for lack of a better word. There's other comedians who I think are very much like, no, political correctness is the enemy of free speech. And those are conversations that are just so prevalent across the board culturally right now that it's just so odd that comedy is a battlefield for all these sort of societal changes to me. And I think the main thing I walk away thinking is that comedians have every right in the world to say what they want and experiment, and they just have to be willing to take the consequences for that. You know, I do think that in the course of comedy, going back, I would say probably Lenny Bruce being like the first name that comes to mind for me of him, you know, him taking on censorship, Carlin taking on censorship, Pryor taking on, you know, I think so much of, you know, what was happening in the 60s and 70s as far as racial movement in society. I feel like comedy has certainly had its moments where it does maybe crack the veneer of traditions as societal change happens, but it is a particularly tumultuous time in comedy where it has come to represent something for people and constant turmoil and think pieces and lack of, you know, just a very, sometimes a lack of responsibility within the comedy community to take ownership of that, and very strange. And I have to say on my level that in 20 years of doing it, I don't know if there's been a time where I have sort of felt less certain of the footing of what it means to be a comedian. And I just try to stake my claim and do my part to make work that I'm proud of and that I think represents something good, and try not to judge other people for what they do. And I just hope that by doing what I do and leading by example, that I can make some work that makes people who share my values feel like they have a comedian they can go to when they want to laugh. Again, another rambly answer, but that time at least it was a legitimately confusing question, because being a comedian right now, it is weird.
Thank you for that.
It's weird. That could have been the short answer. Yeah, man, it's a weird time to be a comedian. That would have been the short one, but it's a lot. It's a lot to think about, and it's a lot to think about what your responsibilities are. Should I still be performing at clubs that put up people who have you know, caused some news for, I think, some really not good stuff, to say the least? Well, if I walk away from those clubs, there was one night I was at one of the clubs, and a female performer was like, well, if a guy like you leaves, I'm even more alone. I'm not in a position career-wise where I can leave. So I'm going, well, what does it mean? How do you navigate all this? How do you try to be someone who puts your head down and does the work and is proud of being able to do what you do, while also maybe having some misgivings about some of the attitudes, both from within and without? Very strange times.
This is sort of tangential, loosely related, but, you know, a figure like Morrissey, you know, who I know you're a huge Smiths fan.
Yeah.
But he's also a complicated figure.
It's getting harder and harder. Yeah.
You know, I'm also a Smiths fan, so I can relate. But how do you mesh with that? Do you subscribe to separating the art from the artist?
It has become more difficult for me. Even you right there, let's all point out, very crafty, I am a Smiths fan. That's a delineation that a lot of people will right now say, I'm a Smiths fan, and not necessarily phrase it as I'm a Morrissey fan. You know, I've been very public. A major running through line in Career Suicide was that I was singing Morrissey lyrics and talking about how he was the musician that got me through a lot of my dark nights. And I've been so proud that people have watched that special and said, well, you wound up doing that for me. And I always felt like that was in some way honoring an artist that did have a profound influence on me. And now you turn around and read quotes where he says things like, yeah, people just want to hang out with others of their own race, and I don't see what's wrong with that. And I just don't see how that's doing the world any good. I don't see how an artist who, for a few generations of people who were depressed, people who felt like their sexuality made them targets, people who felt bullied and picked on, that band in particular was one that made us feel like we were allowed to be proud of who we are and maybe even throw some punches back by standing up and saying who we are publicly and proudly. The idea that he's now the guy saying he had the other one about, why was that kid alone with Kevin Spacey anyway? That's bad parenting. It's like, these are statements that make it harder and harder to reconcile. And I know that he probably, I don't know. I don't know. I'm thinking about getting my tattoo removed. I don't know. It would be such a sad day if I did, but I have a son now. I have a 5-month-old son. When he gets older and says, who is that guy? Or he just goes and Googles him. Is he going to say, do you believe in that stuff too? And I don't. So I think I've learned a real lesson about the difference between being affected by an artist's work and maybe putting that artist on a pedestal to a degree that can come around and bite you.
You know, I think something that is really cool about your work, though, is you've always been kind of breaking down those rules around celebrity, too.
Trying to. And some of that, I think, is just outright anger that I'm never going to be in the club, you know? Like, my show bombed out on cable, and I'll say, too, some bitterness. Like, the year Career Suicide was out, I was really hoping that it would get nominated for an Emmy. It was on HBO, so I felt like I had a chance. And not so I could have validation, but because I was like, man, if this story can be told more places, I think it will do more good. Not so I can sell more tickets, not so I can have more attention. But I realized, I was like, man, I thought that one was good enough to at least get a nomination, and it was on a platform that often does. And I just had to realize at some point, I'm not in the club. And it's, again, another moment of feeling like it would be arrogant to feel like I get to be invited into the club now, because my work, like you said, I've needled that celebrity culture. I've tried to poke holes in how ridiculous it is. An era of reality stars and Instagram influencers. This is something to roll your eyes at. Work that, you know, entertainment that feels so often like it's just being spoon-fed to us in an easy way. I don't mind that people sometimes say my work is impenetrable to them. I don't mind that there's so many comments on the internet from people making fun of my old TV show because they don't get it. I don't want those people to get it. That's fine by me. So I can't then turn around and be bitter that I'm not in the club when I've spent most of my career standing outside the clubhouse throwing rocks at it. It's not a surprise that I don't get invited in, that they're not like, hey, come in, have a drink and a sandwich on us. Like, no, I've spent a lot of time kind of angrily in my own way saying it's an artificial world that is unhealthy and I don't like it.
Well, you also can't time, you know, you can never match up with whatever people decide as prestige or decide as award worthy. I mean, you can't line up with it. But you know,
I know this. I will say in another response to your last question about poking holes in it, I do feel like two of the fan bases. If I could combine the different circles of people who like my work, but the Gethard Show is all millennials, and Beautiful Anonymous, a surprisingly large number of the people who follow that are women, you know, in their 30s, 40s, and above. And I do feel like those are two groups that feel perpetually unlistened to right now. And I am proud that my work is embraced by people who feel like they're not listened to. Just people who feel like they're maybe, they have eyes rolled at them all the time. That's who I want to entertain. I don't need to entertain the people who want it to be easy or who want it to be mean. I just don't need it to be that. I don't want to make that stuff. And that's fine if that means that I have a harder time paying my rent sometimes than someone of my experience level should. That's fine.
Do you see yourself doing a project in the future that doesn't have your face on it or doesn't have you as a subject matter?
Yeah, I'm done with that. Again, I think that's the type of thing that catches fire in your gut in your 20s, and that in my 30s I felt like I needed to get over the finish line. But I don't. No more books with my face on the cover. No more shows with my name in them. I'm very happy to fade into a more happy obscurity. I think a lot about pulling a J.D. Salinger that, you know, a lot less people will care about. But I think a lot about moving to the woods and giving up on it. And especially in relation to the questions about the current state of the comedy scene and the divisiveness that surrounds it. It's just, I just wonder if it's for me anymore. So the thing that is most exciting to me is, you know, doing things that, A, are small and personal to the people who find them. I love Beautiful and Honest because of that. I feel like it feels like once a week you get to have a conversation that is sometimes in many ways with me and this other person that you're included, intimate. I like the idea of smaller, intimate stuff. I also like the idea of of continuing to find the up-and-coming artists who are still driven, who do still have that fire in their gut. Anything I've had to prove, I think I've proved it. And I don't know if that means I'm just going to fade away. But if I do, I will do so very contentedly. But I still see young artists that I'm so impressed by, so impressed by. And it makes me so happy to shout to the hilltops about them. Like, comedians I love right now. Like, there's Carmen Christopher, Martin Urbano, Christy Cielo. There's a girl who just moved from Chicago named Megan Salter, who I think is so full of joy and so brilliant. And I still get so happy and so excited to come across people who are so driven to do interesting work in their own way. And that still gives me so much happiness and so much joy. So I'd rather spend my time and energy telling the world about other people now, because also I'm 40. You don't get to be cool when you're 40. You know, like, I'm not going to be the hipster. I'm running around on public access and whatnot anymore. Like, I'm realistic enough to know that. So I'm happy to fade away, figure out what the next thing is, but let it be more low key. I'm tired. I've done a lot of work I'm proud of, but I'm awful tired. But there's also something to be said for, you know, gracefully knowing when it's time to let someone else pick up the torch and run with it. That's another thing I think about. Career Suicide came out, what, 3 or 4 years ago? And I'm very happy that I think this, it felt shocking when it first came out to hear someone talk about suicide that publicly. I don't think it feels as shocking anymore. I'm proud of that. My show, when we first went to public access, felt very, very progressive and forward-thinking. But the writer's room, the kids who, you know, it was me and three other white guys who met every weekend to plan it. It felt very, very progressive and different back then. Like, it was championing stuff. I'm also aware that in 2019, maybe a guy who looks like me and is as old as I am, maybe should take a little more of a backseat to younger artists who have other things to say. I don't know if I matter as much as I did. And that's fine. That's good to realize. It's fine. I swear I'm okay with it.
Well, thank you so much for opening up about that. Last question. What's your favorite New Jersey body of water?
Oh, wow. Finally a question that's waking me up out of my funk. My favorite New Jersey body of water. There's so many good ones. I mean, the Jersey Shore up and down. The Raritan River represents a lot to me as a Rutgers alum who was not happy there. Are there any? My favorite New Jersey body of water. I tell you what, I've been looking at houses that are on lakes out there. That might be my J.D. Salinger. There's a couple lakes. I'm not going to name them because I don't want people bothering me. I don't know. I will say, too, there's a brook that runs along the bottom of my street that I grew up on, and I have said publicly that I would like my ashes scattered there. So that it probably has to be the brook at the bottom of Allen Street in West Orange, New Jersey. I grew up on the same block as my grandparents, and some of my earliest memories involve playing in this brook. And I still, if I want to be cheesy, I will say I very often think about the fact that I make my work for who I used to be. What's the stuff that me and my brother would have laughed at if we found it on the UHF channels in our basement when we were kids who, you know, honestly got bullied and felt like we didn't have a voice. So I would have to say the brook at the bottom of Allen Street, West Orange, New Jersey. That's where I want my ashes scattered. That's the one.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Oh, please. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And again, sorry I ramble so much. I'll always find a way to apologize.
The American Masters podcast was created by Michael Cantor and is produced by Joe Skinner.
And co-produced by Josh Hamilton, with sound engineering by Josh Broom, Evan Joseph, and John Berman.
For American Masters, we thank series producer Julie Sachs and associate producer Christiana Lombardo. Our theme music is by Infinity Shred.
We'd also like to thank the American Masters interns for their contributions to this episode, Christina Darko and Giovanna Drummond.
Thanks for listening. And please don't forget to give us a rating or a review and tell a friend about us or share a favorite episode. See you in a couple weeks.